And just like that, we're back.
Okay. I don't know why I still feel queasy, even though the tickling is so wholesome. And Cameron's super tickly gang tickle fest looks really cute.
He does have a really big smile on his face.
He doesn't
there.
He?
Yeah.
And see, what's the harm?
And the colourful tracksuits really do give it an air of like adorability.
Don't they?
Don't they? Okay. So I want to tell you guys about the time that the Washington Post won a Pulitzer and then had to give it back 2 days later. Awkward. Okay, so this all happens in the early 80s. A few years after Watergate, which was famously broken by two Washington Post reporters, Woodward and Bernstein. And that was one of the biggest scandals ever broken in the history of journalism. Very, very young children like Cassie may not know the whole story of Watergate.
Not really.
Are you serious?
Like, yeah, never really engaged with it. I was...
When
was it?
All.
When was it?
Kind of early 70s.
Oh, Jesus, yeah, sure. Like,
we weren't born, so...
It's a lifetime.
Well, no, I know, but like, you might know about, like, you know, what's the movie where, you know...
Nixon.
Well, yeah, it's Nixon, and it's all about, like, well, it's actually incredibly convoluted, but basically, like, they were secretly recording political opponents' offices, bugging offices, like, major shit went down.
Well, that's how Nixon was impeached.
And they made a movie of it with fucking Robert Redford. Oh, my God, I could not. Remember, All the President's Men? A Few Good Men. All the President's Men. Oh, God, I have to check now. All the Presidents.
Why are we talking about Watergate?
Sorry. Because, so, Dustin Hoffman played Carl Bernstein and Robert Redford played Bob Woodward. And they were two fast-talking reporters in the 70s for the Washington Post. And they, like, broke the story that, like, ended up in, you know, Nixon's impeachment. And the reason I'm talking about it is because the same paper is at the center of this scandal.
How many years later?
6 years later.
Okay.
Or thereabouts.
So they're riding high.
So they're riding high, thank
you. Nothing can touch us.
I'm trying to give context. It is an age where journalism is like at its kind of peak in terms of like being the voice of the people and having integrity. Nothing like now, basically.
It's respected and people are employed.
and compensated.
Wow.
Compensated generously.
Right.
And yeah, so, and also Woodward is still on the staff of the Washington Post when all this happened in the early 80s. He's like a managing editor now, so he's been kind of promoted. And so it's like 1980 and they make a hire, a new young hotshot reporter called Janet Cook. Is the name ringing any bells?
No.
Alarm bells?
No.
Okay, bullshit buffs will absolutely remember this story.
Nice.
Because
I
Janet
see what you
Cook.
Did there. Just create a new hashtag.
Oh, bullshit buff. Hashtag bullshit buffs. Okay.
I have a visual of someone buffing a shite though.
So Janet Cook basically has like a master's in fuckery. Oh, also journalism students, Cassie, I believe, would know this story because it's actually still taught in a lot of curriculum of journalism courses. So they cover this like nearly 40 years later. It's still taught as a kind of an example of ethics and issues around named sources and unnamed sources.
Okay,
and
okay.
Integrity.
Single sourcing.
Importance of facts.
Right, I'm interested. I did study journalism.
Oh, she's in. Oh, look, she's even put down the crocheting.
She didn't do that for my story.
She deigned to join us in the room.
She's back in the room.
Okay, so look.
I'm sorry, did you do that whole thing just there?
No. I'm making a little owl for the big knit for the top of the innocent bottle of smoothies.
Excuse me.
Segway.
Have they purchased sponsorship on the Creep Dive?
No.
Okay, so in the early 80s, Janet Cook was actually a dream fucking hire for the editors of the Post. So that was the then editor Vivian Alpen Brownlee and the managing editor Woodward of Woodward and Bernstein fame.
Okay.
So Janet Cook was a real find because she basically ticked two quotas for the Post. She was black and she was a woman. So they were only delighted with
creaming themselves.
She was also really fucking young. She was like 25.
Another one.
She was coming from a kind of a regional paper called the Toledo Blade. Very cool name for a town's, like, it's like the D4, whatever that newspaper is. What is that newspaper in Dublin? Anyway.
What?
So what I'm saying is it's a regional paper with a cool name.
Did it exist?
Yes.
Okay.
It did exist. Now, Cook claimed that she had a degree from Vassar College and a master's degree from the University of Toledo, and that she'd also received a journalism award while she was at the Toledo Blade. And she's very young. She's a woman and she's black. So they are very excited. So just as well, kind of important to point out, in their hiring of Cook, they most definitely had an agenda.
Okay.
So like in 1980, the population of Washington, D.C. was 70% black.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say
wow.
that they were definitely seeking to connect with that black readership.
Of course.
In a way that like a kind of a newsroom in the 80s, it'd be even more kind of white and elitist
yeah.
than they are today. And there also seems to be kind of a sense after Cook joined the staff that like there was some pressure on her to cover the kinds of stories that she as a black woman would appear to be uniquely placed to tell.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think they were basically like, go into the streets, get us the stories from the black people in the streets.
Your
and
people.
Bring them back to us and we'll help to, you know, translate them.
Right. They were using her.
For the white people.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a kind of, there's definitely more at play than just bold ambition for what came next, okay? So she'd been on staff for about 6 months when she landed a massive feature that was published on the 28th of September in 1980, and it was called Jimmy's World. So this enormous feature by Cook was a profile about the life of a heroin addict.
Oh, this is, I know you said heroin, but I heard heron.
I'm sorry.
And my mind went elsewhere.
He just loved herons.
Fucking loved. An addict. Just
an addict of the stately heron.
I mean, they are beautiful
they
creatures.
They are proud yeah. birds.
My mind went, is this where Jimmy Eat's World got their name?
I also thought that.
Hmm.
Are we wrong?
I can neither deny nor confirm the Jimmy Eat's World connection.
Mm-hmm.
Herons are beautiful, but I did not mean to say heron. You've also really ruined my little reveal.
Oh,
but anyway, fuck you both.
Well, oh no, go on, have your moment.
So she wrote a profile, I'll start again, of
Jimmy,
a heroin addict who was 8 years old. That is such a weird reaction.
Like, that's just not true.
Okay, well, you're hired on the editorial board of the Washington Post immediately.
It's kind of disappointing to the whole premise of this podcast that things were not true, because it's a spoiler in itself.
Well, yeah, but
like,
oh,
sometimes you can bury the lead,
like,
and
TJ.
Sometimes you can lead with it.
TJ. Yeah.
Okay, this is sounding familiar.
Okay.
To me. Anyway, but go on.
Well, I'll give you a couple of little snippets.
I'm trying to remember. I'm like really trying hard to remember it.
No,
you really
I
won't
can't.
Because you were a minus person in 1980.
As were we.
We were too, but she was especially. I think Cassie was yet to be born by about 12 years.
In 1982.
You were born in 1982.
No, no, I wasn't born until 1990.
She's going on about this all the time. Don't give her another...
2001 or so.
Okay. Do you want to hear some little kind of little extract from Jimmy's World?
Okay, sorry. So it's called, her piece is called Jimmy's World.
Yes.
We're all supposed to believe he's 8.
Yes.
And nobody fucking checked.
But there's an opioid epidemic in the States.
Not in 1980.
No? End of 70s, early 80s, no?
I mean, yeah, like drugs were massive, but like there was nothing like the epidemic that was to come. So, because I read a fair bit around this and it definitely kind of like, it predated a lot of like widespread national knowledge of the drugs crisis. Anyway, so, quote, from Jimmy's World. Jimmy is 8 years old and a third generation heroin addict. Did you just picture heroin again?
No.
A family of heroin enthusiasts.
Third generation addicts.
Yeah.
Fair. I mean, it's good. Yeah.
Okay. A precocious little boy with sandy hair, velvety brown eyes, and needle marks freckling the baby smooth skin of his brown arms.
Nonsense.
No, I'm gripped. Come on, keep going.
He nestles in a large beige reclining chair in the living room of his comfortably furnished house in Southeast Washington.
Sorry, comfortably furnished house?
Yeah.
Right.
Well.
But third generation.
Money in drugs, I guess.
Okay.
Well,
yeah.
Sometimes. There is an almost cherubic expression on his small round face as he talks about life. Clothes, money, the Baltimore Orioles. And heroin. He has been an addict since the age of 5.
There we go.
There we go. So.
Like, I'm sure it happened somewhere. Maybe it's happened.
It's okay. Like that picture of the child who smokes in Korea.
Is that true?
Don't know. That's a future episode.
It's. I mean.
Unless we forget the chimpanzee that smoked.
Well, that's it. I mean, who knows? What the fuck is going on? So, yeah, okay. Sorry, back in the room. Jane,
back in the
we're
room.
With you.
Okay.
I'm
going
to call this episode Back in the Room. You've said it so many times.
Jimmy's is a world of hard drugs, spritz, fast money, and
they
a good
should be
life.
Called. Another Back in the Room, please. Make it a double.
Everyday junkies casually buy heroin from Ron, his mother's live-in lover, in the dining room of Jimmy's house. They cook it in the kitchen and fire up in the bedrooms. And every day, Ron or someone else fires up Jimmy, Jesus. Plunging a needle into his bony arm, Jesus. Sending the fourth grader into a hypnotic nod.
I thought he had a roundy face. Roundy face and a skinny arm.
Mm.
God.
Jimmy wants to sell drugs, maybe even on the district's meanest street, Condon Terrace, Southeast, and someday deal heroin, he says, just like my man Ron. Ron, 27, and recently up from the South, was the one who first turned Jimmy on. Quote, he'd been bugging me all the time about what the shots were and what people was doing, and one day he said, can I get off? Ron says, leaning against a wall in a narcotic haze, his eyes half closed, yet piercing. I said,
God,
well,
this is horrific.
Shit, you can have some now. I let him snort a little, and damn, the little dude really did get off. 6 months later, Jimmy was hooked. I felt like I was a part of what was going down, he says. I can't really tell you how it feel. You never done any? Sort of like them rides at King's Dominion, like if you was to go on all of them in one day. Jimmy's mother, Andrea, accepts her son's habit as a fact of life, although she will not inject the child herself and does not like to see others do it.
Jeez.
I don't really like to see him fire up, she says. But, you know, I think he would have got into it one day anyway. Everybody does. When you live in the ghetto, it's all a matter of survival. If he wants to get away from it when he's older, then that's his thing. But right now, things are better for us than they've ever been. Oh, okay.
So this was published.
Let's get back out of that room for a minute.
God.
I know. Like, ugh. So... this was published and like shit exploded.
Obviously, find Jimmy. Get him out of there.
Find
Help
Jimmy.
Him.
Help him. The piece did the 80s equivalent of going viral. It was reprinted around the country and around the world. It was massive.
Where was Jimmy?
So At the time, Marion Barry was mayor of DC. That's a man called Marion, just to be confusing. He had his own little issues later.
With herons, was it?
Well, he was smoking the herons.
Oh, smoking with the herons.
He was caught on video smoking just crack.
Rolling a full bird.
And then he also was somehow re-elected into a mayoral office after that.
America. America.
So basically, the mayor, city health and police officials like immediately started trying to find the child, you know, with a view to prosecuting his guardians. The Post stood fast behind its First Amendment rights to protect its reporter from having to reveal the boy's whereabouts.
Well, that's a little sketchy when it comes to a child, surely.
Yes, and the paper was heavily criticised, unsurprisingly, by, you know, black residents in Washington, D.C.
Because, come on, like, what they've done is taken the lowest common denominator in terms of the most vulnerable.
Mm.
And anyway, yeah, obviously they were criticised.
Well, they're blowing real pain that really exists in a community. And they're blowing it up onto kind of like a huge kind of blockbuster level.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very problematic. And I think as well, like, there must have been a real disconnect, I think, between Janet Cook's superiors and herself. I think that the superiors were like looking at her and going, she's black, she must know what she's talking about with regards to this community, even though she's from a very upper middle class black family in the suburbs.
Okay.
You know what I mean? But like there's this kind of disconnect basically. And also the First Amendment rights, like, that says that journalists don't have to reveal their sources, has had up until then been like utterly crucial in breaking massive stories that had huge political ramifications.
Sure, who would ever come forward with anything?
Well, again, Watergate was really hinged on an unnamed source and like took down a really corrupt political system.
Well, just say the president.
There's two sides to it there. Now, obviously, a young child's life is potentially at stake, so it leaves an icky taste that the Post wouldn't cough up.
Okay.
So the place, basically, like, the city went bananas over this, clearly. And
hate to be your one at this point.
Oh, like, my God. It. So Jimmy was never found. City officials organized an all-out police search for the boy, which was unsuccessful. And then there did begin to be rumblings around the story being fraudulent. And
what
then,
had she revealed of, you know, so she wasn't under any kind of obligation to reveal any more than she had written about them in this piece?
Yeah, well, she had, say, notes, interview transcripts and tapes, but she had no transcripts or tapes for the actual central interview, which was with Jimmy, Ron and Jimmy's mother.
Well, surely that would come under her not disclosing her witnesses as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So she was allowed to say...
Well, the Post protected her.
Okay.
So as I said, city officials launched an all-out search. Then the mayor, later crack-smoking mayor, responding to public pressure, panicked, lied, and claimed that Jimmy was known to the city and receiving treatment... And then sometime later, he just said, Jimmy's dead.
What?
So the mayor...
Did the mayor know Jane?
Janet. No, not at all.
So why the fuck would he do this?
Because the mayor looks bad for this going on in his city and it not being protected.
Yeah.
And he also was smoking crack. So he could have just been really high.
I think initially when he launched the search, he was just like, I just want to know about Jimmy's connection. I just want to find this Ron guy. And then the other people were like, Mayor Barry, maybe some concern for the child's welfare. And he's like, that too.
And he probably doesn't want people digging into drug dealers.
Okay.
He doesn't want, like, it's within his interest to just pretend this whole story is going away.
Well, in fairness, now this is speculation because I don't know when his drug use started. It was definitely later that he was caught. So we just cover
Did anybody get helped in the kind of mass search for this boy.
Like, would the lot of any of the poorest black residents of Washington, D.C. improved in any way?
Presumably, like, a few stones were overturned. Not.
I don't
maybe
think so.
Maybe other children might have been, you know, suspected to be him and maybe helped along the way, you know?
I don't think that really happened. I think it turned into a mass arse covering by a whole lot of white men.
Right.
You know, I think that a lot of damage was done actually instead to black people as a result of this. I'll go on and we can come back to it. But basically, it just painted this grotesque picture of black families as well. Of course. Like, do you know?
Perpetuated all the kind of misconceptions
that white middle class families in the early 80s probably had already. You know, I don't, well, like that's sweeping, but you know.
Well, it doesn't look good for the Post.
It does not look good for the Post, which is why what they did next is kind of baffling. So there was rumblings within the Post, a few people kind of like airing doubts and misgivings about the story's veracity, even while the paper was actively publicly defending it. And that's when assistant managing editor Bob Woodward submitted the story for the Pulitzer Prize.
Interesting. At what point did he submit it?
Like
during the madness.
Yeah.
During the rumblings that it might not be true?
Yeah. Amid rumblings that it might not be true, amid the mayor killing off a fictitious boy, he said, might win the Pulitzer for this. And so, lo, they did win the Pulitzer for feature writing on 3rd of April 1981. So, roughly 7 months after the story had appeared.
What did they win it for?
They won it for feature writing, journalism.
So, did she win it? Like, it was, what's that Pulitzer? It means it was well written. It was just a very important piece of journalism.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, I mean, I don't know who gets to keep the actual prize. Is that what you're asking? Do the Washington Post have it or does Janet Cook?
Yeah.
No one has it anymore. So basically, they won on April 13th, right? And so, obviously, big news. It was, you know, picked up by everyone. It was a landmark win because she was the first black woman to win the Pulitzer. She was very young. She was at the start of her career. She was, you know, kind of being mentored by Bob Woodward, who was a complete icon of American journalism. So then her old editors at the Toledo Blade were very proud of their girl, having gone off, done good. And they started to write up the story. Former Toledo Blade reporter wins Pulitzer. And they were fact-checking their report against their own biographical details that they would have had on her from a kind of a HR point of view.
Okay.
And that's when they noticed a few discrepancies around Cook's supposed academic credentials. So the stories have been picked up by the Associated Press and stuff. So the Toledo
Blade. But also,
Blade,
who cares? Are we talking about her faking a degree or something?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a big deal?
I think fake a degree, fake a boy, fake
right,
a...
Right, okay.
I don't know. It just don't lie. Usually don't. Especially if you're a journalist.
Big lies. Yeah, okay. If you're a journalist.
It's all so key.
Okay.
To being a journalist.
I guess. What, are you taking an oath or something?
Well,
you kind of
there's a code of ethics. There's a code of conduct, bedrock.
You have your like your list of ethics and a code of conduct that you do agree to, and that gives you that by agreeing and adhering to that code of conduct, you then you can avail of certain protections within the law. So, like, not revealing your sources. What
depends on if you were playing.
It's definitely hairy.
Look, this is a big story. If somebody won the Pulitzer and you were like, hang on a minute though, they've just lied on their CV here.
How big of a poo is in Janet's knickers right now?
Absolutely breaking it, I'd say. The actual fucking stress.
We've all done a bit of cheating on exams and tests in our time.
We've all done a bit of spoofing in our first job.
I
seem to remember claiming that I was well versed in AutoCAD when I was an assistant production designer,
what
also briefly.
What the fuck is that?
Do you remember AutoCAD?
Computer drawing?
Oh, terrifying. Yeah, yeah. Back God, in the room. God, I doubt it exists anymore.
What happened to her?
So the Toledo Blade realized that she had definitely lied about her academic credentials. So 14th of April, day after the Pulitzer's been announced, shit starts to go down. So sometime after 3 PM, Bradley and managing editor Howard Simmons over at the Washington Post received simultaneous phone calls. One is from an Associated Press editor. They're obviously digging. And the other is an assistant to the president of Vassar who wanted to have a word with the editor, Bradley. So both callers were asking about Janet's CV. Mm. Okay. So this was damning. Okay. This was, on the one hand, a reporter sniffing around, trying to find out exactly what Janet had been claiming. And another, like a high-ranking academic from Vassar calling to obviously straighten things out and say this woman does not possess a master's degree, or she's only ever attended Vassar for 1 year and she received a bachelor's, not a master's. And, you know, basically there's a bit of spoofology going on there. Bradley is fucking pissed. And he turns to some minion and says, take her to the woodshed.
What the fuck does that mean?
I'll tell you what it means. It means that for nearly 11 hours in various locations, offices, conference rooms, in a car.
She was grilled.
They were grilling Janet Cook. They were literally driving her around in a car around Southeast Washington, D.C., looking for Jimmy's house.
So I mean, she didn't have to tell.
You would be absolutely petrified.
And she lasted 11 hours.
She lasted 11 hours as she was alternately interrogated, cajoled, comforted, intimidated, flattered. By
not like, by the police, like four by men, the Washington Post.
By the editors of the Washington Post. Four men, basically.
Squeezing the truth out of her.
Finally, and I think this is very telling, the time of this. Finally, at 1:45 in the morning.
God love her.
Janet Cook confessed, there is no Jimmy and no family. It was a fabrication. I want to give the prize back.
Fuck. Janet, because presumably that was a well-written piece. So she was a good writer. I mean, at the very least, she had a good imagination. Well, stop. That's a genuine thing.
They don't give Pulitzers out for good imaginations.
In fairness, like...
what's that Melissa McCarthy movie that's out
Gail
now?
Garcia Marquez, who's like a really famous writer, did say it's a shame that she was awarded the Pulitzer for journalism when she, you know, deserved a prize for fiction. Actually, I beg to differ because I've read Jimmy's World in its entirety and I think it's a terrible piece of writing as well.
Okay.
Well, it is. And it's so...
Do they give the Pulitzer every year?
Knowing that it's completely faked, it just then screams like cliche and derivative. Do you know what I mean? Like all the black speak in it is so offensive once you realize all of it is invented.
Okay.
So what by somebody who is not from this world.
What became of her?
What became of her? I wanted to tell Jen whether the Pulitzer Prize is an annual award.
Yeah, I feel like, kids, you know, when you think about it, the Oscars,
it is
every
annually
year.
Awarded. It is annually
like,
awarded.
That comes around quick.
There's enormous
the
prestige
bar
in it.
Drops.
And it's for journalism, literary achievements, and music. And
oh,
drama.
That's across a lot.
Yeah, but there's only seven.
Coldplay obviously didn't release an album that year.
But there's only seven awarded each year. So in those categories.
Seven? That's a lot.
Okay, all right. Well, why don't you go get your Pulitzer, Jen, and come back to us.
Pulitzer.
Maybe I will.
And the Pulitzer for the Half-Baked Podcast goes to.
You're just raging because you would have done Tickle better. But I got in there first.
Oh, I really enjoyed yours.
Okay, back in the room, kids.
We gotta get out of the room. We've been talking for a really long
basically,
time.
Basically, Janet is 25. She's just claimed that she knew AutoCAD before she took on this job. And then she just shit her pants and didn't know what the hell else to do but lie. So basically, what happens was, the next day,
you should have
two days after...
Sorry.
the Pulitzer was awarded. The paper published a public apology. Woodward said at the time, "I believed it, we published it. Official questions had been raised, but we stood by the story and her. Internal questions had been raised, but none about her other work. The reports were about the story not sounding right, being based on anonymous sources and primarily about purported lies about her personal life. Mm. Told by three reporters, two she had dated and one who felt in close competition with her." So, okay. Compromised. "I think the decision to nominate the story for a Pulitzer is of minimal consequence." Do you, Woodward? Because it seems like it brought a lot of attention into this massive fuck-up of yours.
What anyway, happened to him?
I also think that it won. The fact that it won is of little consequence. Still disagreeing hard with you here.
Well, I agree. A lot of them were getting out.
"It is a brilliant story, fake and fraud that it is. It would be absurd for me or any other editor to review the authenticity or accuracy of stories that are nominated for prizes." What? All of that is baffling nonsense out of the mouth of a really, really respected American journalist.
Well,
it's fucking fascinating.
Burned, obviously.
Oh, yeah. Massively burned. And I also think he probably was like, I'm just going to have the quiet life in this nice role. And now this stupid, annoying young one's come and like wrecked my buzz.
This should be a film. Is it a film?
Oh, well. Mm-hmm. So in January of 1982, Cook appeared on the Phil Donahue show and basically gave her kind of main interview that she ever gave about it. She blamed the high pressure environment of the Post. She said it corrupted her judgment.
Sure.
She said that she had done extensive interviews about Cassie's heading off. She's out. She just doesn't care anymore.
I'm still here. I'm in the room. This has been a very long episode.
I'm sorry.
I'm still with you. What's happening?
I'm here. Sorry.
I nearly finished. Okay. So, geez, like.
Come on. I'm with you. I'm salivating still.
She'd done loads of interviews in the area because basically one of the editors had been like, go out and get us a story from the kind of underbelly of the poor black community. I'm sorry. Okay, I know you can't see the face I'm making on a podcast, but obviously it seems pretty gross. Like the motivation behind it all seems gross. Dispatching her to go get this story.
Yeah, you can see where the pressure
is. She said that sources had hinted to her about the existence of such a boy, but she was unable to find him. So eventually she created a story in order to satisfy her editors.
But she could have created something under the radar, you know, sensational wise.
Yeah.
She just blew her load there and she fucking smoked a heron.
She smoked a heron is absolutely fucking terrible
Boy
timing.
Eat smokes heron.
Because everything post World War II in terms of journalism had been kind of very crusading and very meaningful.
Well, she felt that's what they
like,
wanted
if you think
from her.
About
and
where
she delivered
that was coming
that.
From in World War II, like propaganda basically steered the world into disaster. So after that.
Similar to what's happening now.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, like, that's why, you know, freedom of press became so essential in the intervening decades. And then basically she kind of slammed into the 80s with this kind of bullshit, which obviously kind of challenged whether or not journalists should be allowed to keep their unnamed sources protected. So, anyway, that all kind of died down and Janet Cook completely fucking disappeared. Until 1996, when she gave an interview about the whole Jimmy's World affair to a former boyfriend of hers called Mike Sager, who had worked on the Post at the same time as her. He'd gone on to become a reasonably respected journalist. He did this interview and it was published in GQ. And it was very bleak, actually, as an interview. But the film rights were sold to TriStar Pictures for $1.6 million. So they did get that money.
Okay.
But the project has never moved past development stages. And, you know, Cook's life has just really, like, stalled and...
Shit.
Been pretty crap. She basically told Sager, what I did was wrong. I regret that I did it. I was guilty.
She was 25.
I did it and I'm sorry that
24?
I did it. Yeah.
Yeah, but like she's working in it. I don't care. She studied journalism in some capacity. You'd know not to lie. You don't make up things. It's just, it's the fundamentals of storytelling. You don't make it up. You don't publish something that's not true in a national paper and expect it to all be okay.
Yeah. I read an update from Mike Seeger, who wrote another article about her called The Fabulous Who Changed Journalism, which is a pretty good article. And he, at the end of it, kind of comes clean at the end of this piece and says, I actually used to go out with Janet Cook. Mm. I am nominally in touch with Cook now via email. I don't think I will betray her trust by reporting that she's still living within the borders of the United States, within a family setting, and pursuing a career that does not primarily involve writing. I've heard different things that she works in a department store. She's worked in Bloomingdale's.
Kind of suggesting that she's sort of dangerous in some way, which I don't think is true.
Well, anyway, apparently he says, I faithfully forward all requests for interviews, but Cook consistently declines to speak further of her role in the Pulitzer scandal.
Oh, that's a shame.
Clearly it has taken a toll.
Yeah.
She's written to him, what more is there for anyone to write? And then she added, he says, in her typical droll fashion, essentially, I've spent the last 30 years waiting to die. Fucking knowing her as I do, says Seeger, she was only half kidding.
Like that's
so dead. That is that's the end of the sad. Saga.
Yeah.
I think that it's so crazy because in a way, if this had all taken place now in like our current 24-hour news cycle, she'd have recovered by Tuesday.
Yeah, probably.
In a weird way. Like sometimes I think that the level of kind of surveillance that we're all experiencing is so fucking toxic and how are we all going to stand it? But at the same time, people move on so fast now.
I don't know. Jordan Woods is having a pretty bad week.
Who? Oh, I don't even know what's going on with that. I couldn't get involved.
It's bad. It's going on for a couple of days. Yeah, I agree. But I think that the reason that people move past it now is because our standards for journalism are so much lower.
Well, that's
you
would true.
Expect a fake news story that's in your true. Daily mix of stories. But you would... I'm glad that that was held on a... You know,
held
not
up.
That she was... Not that her life has been ruined because of it, but, you know, journalism in the late 70s, early 80s was a watchdog, and to brutalize it and to use it to, for essentially to get clicks, to get readers, to portray
for
a story, to try
and,
and become, to try and seem relevant with a target audience. I have no sympathy.
I think as well, the real kind of point of contention and anger is that she has tarnished Black people's reputation
absolutely
in a newsroom.
But hang on,
it was obviously believed and so well, it's so well received and received the Pulitzer because she made that story credible for that community
because of who she was and the pressure she was under during that time. She was hired.
No, you get there's pressure, but you don't put together a fictitious story that's damaging to a group of people, to an already vulnerable group of people. Make it seem that this is because you can be guaranteed that they did not reach as many people with the fact checking and the corrections as they did with the initial story. So there are probably people who still believe that that 8-year-old heroin addict existed, that there was a Black child being raised in a family that allowed them to do drugs because that's so normal in that community. You know, it was just, it's too damaging.
Yeah. It's astoundingly insulting. There is actually a note at the top of Jimmy's World if you seek it out online now. The following article is not factually correct.
But the fact that the article
is fabrication
is still there
by the author. I know. Isn't it fascinating that it's still there? It is still there. I
obviously
think it's
added to the internet at some point in the 90s or the noughties.
Yeah, updated.
So
keeping it with us.
It obviously, it achieved something for the Washington Post at the detriment of that young journalist and at the detriment of a community.
And also, I just think as well, like, I know you said it kind of joking earlier, but like, I think there is kids in situations that is harrowing, and it's so distasteful to characterize that suffering in a piece like this. Like, if you read it, it really sickens me, like that she sat down
and... It was still an act, she didn't physically harm... did cause harm, but she's now... It sounds like it's ruined her life.
Oh yeah, I would say.
And I'm not sure...
And I've no doubt that, there were editors putting her under pressure.
Absolutely.
And editors throwing her under the bus.
Yeah, of
after
course.
After all, they're the editor too.
You can imagine her having difficulty saying to her, look, I'm getting a bit of... take back here, I'm not finding what I need to find, and them saying to her, you better fucking find this, the reason that you're hired is because of this. you know, the pressure must have been immense.
Yeah.
Oh my God, how did she sleep at night?
Anyway, God love her. And it's terrible. Thank you. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, guys.
It's been War and Peace. And hopefully we've brought you through one day into the next with our 4-hour podcast.
We've been with you. We're touching points with people all week now. I'd say that was so long.
Okay.
We just went on a long weekend.
It was
with
long
you.
There now, guys.
Just a bank holiday weekend.
How long is this? Is it like breaking 2 hours?
We're fast approaching 2 hours. Like,
well, we're only prolonging the agony. Follow us on Instagram at The Creep Dive. Feel free to turn off at any point.
Again, let's keep people on the podcast. Okay. Maybe we'll shorten it down next time.
Stick with us.
Bye.
Next week.
Or wait, should we be saying anything?
No, yes, the shows are sold out.
The live shows are sold out.
I just want to remind everyone about Oyster Man.
Okay. Give Jen her juice.
Oh, yeah, because it's been 2 hours since you actually mentioned that. So people have probably forgotten. Oyster Man, live shows are sold out. Do come if you bought your ticket. Please don't stand us up. And follow us on the Instagram.
Bye.
Bye.